As I said, we're at the top of the hour here, so I'm going to go ahead and switch gears to another topic. So this hour, we will talk about the ban on asthma inhalers. Then we'll talk about Palestinian statehood, which was sought at the UN this week, and finally the GOP debates. So first, as I said, by the end of this year, if you are a consumer of the over-the-counter asthma inhalers, and these are the ones, I'm not very familiar with the particular types of inhalers, but they have two different drugs. One of them is sold over-the-counter, and it requires the use of chlorofluorocarbons in order to atomize it, put it in the air so that you can breathe it in as an inhalant. It's epinephrine is the drug in that one. Then there is a prescription type which has a different drug called albuterol. And that is the one that you will have to use as of December 31st due to the Obama administration, its Food and Drug Administration. They said on Thursday that patients who use the epinephrine inhalers will need to switch by December 31st to other types that do not contain chlorofluorocarbons, which is an aerosol substance that was found in a variety of spray products, and I guess now it's being found in fewer and fewer products. That chlorofluorocarbon is thought to damage the ozone layer. So you are being asked to no longer be able to buy these over-the-counter inhalants because of the ozone layer. You've got to help preserve the ozone layer. Now, when I announced this story earlier today, I actually made a mistake. It is not the EPA. It is the FDA that is responsible for issuing this order that's going to ban these over-the-counter inhalants. And it just shows you that these other factors, other than protecting our health and safety, come into play in the FDA's calculations when they're supporting either protecting or allowing certain things to be sold. They're supposed to be concerned with protecting our health, but here we've got these other concerns coming into play. So that's kind of disturbing. Why is it that they are doing this? Is it just, on their own that they decided to do this? Not exactly. It's because the United States signed an agreement with other nations to stop using substances that deplete the ozone layer. I don't know exactly when this was done. It could have been done under Bush. I wouldn't put it past him. Usually these sorts of things are signed years in advance before they actually come into effect. So Lord knows when it was signed, but now it's, they have to phase this out. So by December 31st of this year, go buy everything off the shelf that you can get of this stuff, and hopefully it'll last you a while. It doesn't expire too quickly and you can continue to use it. Why? Because these epinephrine inhalers that are available over the counter or even online, they typically retail for about $20. The alternatives that contain this other drug range from about $30 to $60. And of course, it's not just the price of the item, it's the fact that you would need a prescription in order to get it, which means a doctor's visit, all the cost inherent in a doctor's visit. And under Obamacare, who knows when you're going to get to your doctor? I mean, the story is really, it really, really made me upset. And it made me more upset than some of the previous stories in which the government is saying that you have to do things on behalf of the environment, such as give up your incandescent light bulb, for instance, or use low flush toilets, or have more fuel efficient cars, which usually means less safe cars because they have to weigh less. Washing machines. Right? The front-loading washing machines that are environmentally friendly apparently don't wash our clothes as well as the other ones did. Often what I do is I take that environmentally friendly washing machine and I'll put the extra rinse cycle on because I don't trust it to wash my clothes well enough. Sometimes I end up washing things twice if they're really dirty because I just want to make sure they get clean. Dryers, refrigerators, air conditioners, all this stuff has happened in the past, and everyone basically knows that whenever environmentally friendly products are mandated, they're almost always worse. I've got an article from theweeklystandard.com, and someone's complaining about the low-flow toilets and how badly they work, and they get kind of graphic about it. And then they talk about the dryers and all those other things. The other thing that they don't even talk about here, besides the fact that you have to go to a doctor, is these are two different drugs. What if epinephrine is better for your particular type of asthma? It is better for your metabolism, you know, your particular body chemistry. Everyone's a little bit different. What if people have a bad reaction to this albuterol? Or maybe the albuterol is more addictive, or, I mean, who knows? So there's a lot more than just the bare price. And of course, the price itself, it's at least a 50% increase for people who are on this. So I was thinking about why it was that this particular environmental regulation and ban has gotten me more upset. I was pretty upset about the incandescent light bulbs because I love certain brands of incandescent light bulb. I like the quality of the light. So I'm upset about it, but I'm not as upset about it as this. And I don't have asthma. I know someone who does suffer from mild cases of asthma. I just have this picture in my mind of how blatantly anti-life this particular regulation is, because I see a person coughing and choking because they have asthma, and then you've got standing over her some government bureaucrat who's blathering on about how he's saving the ozone layer and isn't that great, while this person is coughing and choking. It is such a vivid concretization of how concern for the environment has nothing to do with protecting the environment in order to enhance human life. You know, you enjoy going to the beach and looking at a beautiful sunset. You enjoy going to Yellowstone Park and communing with nature. It's not about that. I mean, it's literally about human beings not living as well, as long, as healthfully in order to, quote, preserve the environment. But if we're not here, I mean, you've got all these people choking and dying because they can't treat their asthma or something, who's going to be there to enjoy the environment, and what value does it have? So in my mind, this goes in the revulsifying and disgustipating category. How about for you, Bosch? Yeah? You agree?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And you know what? His daughters, they clearly don't have asthma. I mean, Obama's daughters. And those were Bushness.
Or maybe they do, and maybe he's that evil.
Maybe he's hoarding them for her. So, well, you know, I'll take them all. Well, it's just, it is so evil. And that graphic that you have, it's a perfect cartoon.
Right. Ed makes a funny comment here. He says, you're making a distinction between the EPA and the FDA. He says, understandable confusion. Yeah. I don't know which alphabet soup agency is ruining my life this week. Sometimes I, you know, throw the wrong alphabet letters out there. But this is truly, truly, truly monstrous. And I was horrified to hear about it, and I think it is a perfect, perfect concretization of what the environmentalist agenda means in practice. And in fact, when Bosch and I were talking about the show, we said he's got to make some sort of cartoon where you've got the person hacking and hacking and coughing because of asthma, and the government bureaucrat saying, oh, so sorry, you know that inhaler that was cheap and worked great for you? Can't use it anymore because of some far-off danger about the ozone layer. And if you think about how much of that chlorofluorocarbon must be emitted by those little tiny inhalers. I mean, it's nothing compared to hairspray. Okay, you say hairspray, you know, it's just for us to look nice. But even, you know, even that I resent. But with this,
it trumps human life.
Yeah.
And that's as clear an example as we've ever seen.
I was wondering if there's anyone online here who does perhaps suffer from asthma. I won't give out your name if you're embarrassed about it, but I'm just curious to know if there's a difference between these two drugs that is going to make a difference for people as well. You know, is there a reason that you would want to use the epinephrine for as long as possible and maybe put off the use of the prescription albuterol longer in
this
order
is a conscious choice of holding, you know, the environment above human life in this kind of way. Again, it is incredible.
Yeah.
And that they can actually think that they can get away with this. And they got about a lot of backlash online. And bloggers are going off on it.
I'm glad to see it. And of course, I myself am signing myself up for more Attack Watch by contesting this. Of course, they'll come back and they'll say it's untruthful. You know, epinephrine is not that great anyway, and albuterol is fine.
And then they'll slip and say, well, the environment is more important than human life. I mean, yeah.
Well, and then, of course, I'm wrong to say that under Obamacare, it's going to be any harder to get the prescription for the albuterol than it is now. That's very unfair of me. You know, there haven't been enough studies to show that. So
basically, you know, don't call me what I am. It's like a Pakistan the old day, you know, saying, hey, you know, if you keep accusing us of not being on your side. He's like, if you keep accusing us of doing what we're doing, we will stop being your ally. We will stop pretending to be your ally. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly. Now, John says this issue should be brought up in the next debate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then,
and at least a candidate should bring it up even by himself.
No, I think someone like Kane. But of course, save these up for when they're actually going to be debating Obama. I hope that we have somebody good that's going to be debating Obama and is just going to wipe the floor with them. It's going to be good if we can watch this. Ed says environmentalists would have objected to cavemen lighting fires to keep warm and cook their food. Yes, right. Yeah, and they are anti-man to the core. I think this particular example just shows it so concretely, because I just picture that person with the asthma coughing and hacking and suffering, and that's what this regulation means. That's what signing those international treaties to preserve the environment, you know. And when you think of all the, you know, the meetings that take place when they sign these treaties to preserve the environment, and each of them is flown in on their equivalent of Air Force One, and all the fuel that is expended and everything. And if you think about all that being done, and then the trade-off is this person who really needs this inhalant and they can't have it while Obama's jetting around on Air Force One. I mean,
Deborah wants to speak.
It just makes me disgusted. I'll grab her real quick, and then we got to zoom on to our next fun topic, which is Palestinian statehood. Do you have something quick on the asthma issue? Deborah, hi.
Yeah, just real quick about the ozone layer. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wanted to point out real quick about this issue with the ozone layer, that the ozone is created by photochemical reactions in the outer atmosphere, and it can actually be replenished. It's not like some kind of fixed quantity that has been there since the Earth formed, and that once it's depleted, it can't be replaced.
Right.
So that's just adding a whole nother layer of just evil to this, banning this particular type of asthma inhaler, because a person's life cannot be replaced, but this ozone can. And so it's even if the tiny amount of chlorofluorocarbons from those inhalers did, you know, maybe deplete a little bit of the ozone, if they even made it out there to the outer atmosphere, that ozone could just as easily be replenished by just photons from the sun hitting it.
Right.
Or hitting the compounds that are out there in the troposphere and can be replenished. So it's not necessary at all.
Well, I was going to say thank you for adding that, but then, of course, that makes it even worse. So it's going to make me more upset. So
sorry.
It's okay. Let's get through our next unpleasant topic, and then we're going to have one that's a little bit more pleasant, because we get to talk about Herman Cain winning the straw poll at the end of this, which I think is a little bit more on the upbeat. So next topic, Palestinians seek statehood at the UN, says the story in the Wall Street Journal. And of course, everybody who's listening probably knew that this week, that this was going to happen. Up to the last minute before Abbas, you know, they call him Palestinian President Abbas. And why they can call him a president when he doesn't have a country, I don't know. They give him the title. They're already acting as if he has a country. This just seems like a formality, you know, when they call him that. But up to the moment when he was going to put in this application, petition, whatever it is, you know, Greg Gutfeld was really funny on this week. He said, you know, what is in this application? Do you write an essay? You know, like a, you know, application for college or something? What's in it? But in any event, they were trying to have, they called a quartet of powers that were going to talk the Palestinians out of applying for statehood. And this consisted of the U.S., the European Union, the U.N., and then Russia together were supposedly working to try to get them to return to negotiations. And they, you know, they've had so many plans for negotiations. This one is supposed to take place over a year, and then there were going to be direct negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and they were going to have comprehensive proposals on borders and security within 3 months, and then there were going to be these further steps. They wouldn't take it, the Palestinians. It says the Palestinians didn't formally respond to the quartet's offer, but they said privately that it didn't address their two most pressing requirements for returning to negotiations. That word bothers me too. It says these include a complete freeze on Jewish construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and Israel's willingness to use its borders prior to the 1967 Six-Day War as a baseline for talks, while recognizing the need for some territorial swaps. Now, gee, who did they get the idea for that from? Right? Do you remember, Bosch? From whom did they get this idea for... From whom did they get this idea, you know, to say that they wanted to use the 1967 Six-Day War borders?
Exactly right.
They got it from Obama, right?
And
Obama gave that talk earlier this year. And
exactly.
Said that
why are they pushing this issue now?
Yeah.
You know, why are they pushing this now in this way? Because Obama. Because he's there. Because he's
weak. And they want to go ahead and put this petition before the UN. And, of course, when Abbas spoke before the UN, he got standing ovations. So that would have made me thrown up. I would have thrown up right there if I had seen
Abbas
him.
Abbas turd.
Yeah. And so don't show me a video of it because I might... He said that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, this is Abbas, he says it was the principal issue standing in the way of stability in the Mideast. And it says that Abbas charged the international community with denying his people a homeland for over six decades. Now, if people are concerned to find the truth out about this, you can go David Horowitz on his Freedom Center, David Horowitz's Freedom Center website. They have all of these issues addressed. The history of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is there for everyone to read. You know, the Palestinians, as they call themselves, they have not been repatriated in any of the Arab countries, whereas the Israelis had to take in a whole bunch of refugees that were Jewish, and they did. They took in an equivalent amount into a very small country, Israel. But of course, all the surrounding Arab countries that surround Israel, they couldn't be bothered to take in an equivalent amount of Palestinians. So this idea that there was no place for them to go is apparently a myth. Now, this here is not a paraphrase, but a quote from Abbas. He says, "It is a moment of truth, and my people are waiting to hear the answer of the world. Will it allow Israel to continue its occupation, the only occupation in the world?" End quote, said Mr. Abbas. Now, this so-called occupation is because Israel found it necessary in order to defend itself to take certain territories during that Six-Day War back in 1967, because without the vantage point that this territory gives them, they're not able to effectively defend themselves. So as Netanyahu says, he says that the Palestinians, that, you know, the problem really is that the Palestinians have refused to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And he says, instead, you know, there isn't this problem with the settlement activity. That's not the primary motivator for the conflict. It's the fact that the Palestinians are refusing to recognize Israel. And this is a quote from Netanyahu. He says, "The core of the conflict is not the settlements. The settlements are a result of the conflict." End quote. And I think that's perfect. It, you know, the settlements and the borders that Israel is asserting now are a result of the fact that they had to defend themselves from aggression that they experienced back in the 1960s. So if you say, oh, go back to the 1967 borders as a baseline, and I've said this before, if you go back and say that you have to have that as a baseline, you are saying that everything that Israel did to defend itself was invalid. You know, so I think people who assert these things need to do their research. They need to look at the geography of Israel. They need to see what it is, you know, that is necessary for Israel to defend itself. Do they need those territories? That is what Netanyahu argues, and I would tend to believe him. You know, that's how they've been able to stay relatively safe and keep themselves protected all these years. And to ask them to retreat from that, I don't think it's going to work. I don't think, for instance, that if they recognize a Palestinian state, that that's going to be the end of this. I think it's just the beginning. And didn't you say there was an ambassador, Bosch, who said that this was the first step in eliminating Israel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I forgot who what, but yeah. I mean,
I think it might have been an Iranian ambassador who had said that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right. So this is not about a state either. I mean, you know,
of course
getting
not
a state for Palestinians.
It's about dead Jews.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their cause. Yeah. I mean, that is their cause.
Netanyahu also reminded the UN General Assembly that Israel pulled out all of its security forces and settlers from Gaza Strip in 2005, but that the militant group Hamas filled the power vacuum in the Palestinian territory. And of course, what did Hamas do since then, since 2005? Fire rockets from the Gaza Strip over into Israel. So that shows that Gaza is a convenient location from which to attack Israel, and that's why they had it in the first place. So there you've got a little bit of proof, right, in this article.
I wish Israel would just really unleash a little, go to where they are. I mean, these Hamas and the other guys, they have offices. They have actual addresses. They can go there and bomb them.
Well, and sometimes they do, but they
innocent
don't.
Civilian. Yeah, not all the way. Just kill them.
Yeah, they
get over with.
Yeah, they don't do it enough. Now, U.S. officials have lobbied Abbas for months to try to return to these direct negotiations with the Israelis and say that this is the only path to peace, but it hasn't happened. And then it says in this article, this is a Wall Street Journal article that I picked up, it says, the U.S. Congress, meanwhile, has threatened to cut off hundreds of millions of dollars in annual financial assistance to the Palestinian Authority if Mr. Abbas goes forward. So he's gone forward. Now the big question is, will they cut off the hundreds of millions of dollars in financial assistance? I sure hope that they will, but I use that word hope here because, you know my post, people who know me know my post online, hope is just a little bit better than despair. It literally is just this emotion of hope that I have because from what I've seen from Boehner, there's been all sorts of threats to do this or that, and I haven't seen hardly any of them come true, unfortunately.
Also, this one thing about the funding, we fund a terrorist, quote-unquote, country in Palestine. It's not a country, but we fund them.
Right. Yeah.
They take that money, they build weapons, they kill Jews.
And suppose they say, okay, we're going to trace every dollar, and we're going to show you that every dollar that you give United States goes to feed poor, hungry Palestinians. So suppose that's true. What it does then is it frees up the money that would go to pay the poor, hungry Palestinians so that they can buy the weapons. Yes. Of course, I don't know that they even have to buy the weapons that much anyway, because Iran is supplying them. Apparently, there's 10,000 missiles and Grad rockets supplied by Iran, according to Netanyahu. So he pointed, apparently his speech was pretty good, the speech that Netanyahu gave. But
as far as politicians give, yeah.
Yeah, it's frustrating because he gives a speech, but then what does he do in practice?
Well, he's been weak. I mean, he had a chance in the 90s. He shook Arafat's hand, and that was it for him. I think he lost his soul. I really do. You don't shake a mass murderer's hand.
Yeah.
And since then, he's been weak, and then he came back, and he's done nothing. He really has. He speaks very well. He has some good rhetoric outside of power. In power, he stinks.
Right. No, and it's been so disappointing because sometimes when you hear a speech from him, he sounds so good. And then
he sounds like the moral leader of the world, right, of the free world. He does. And then does nothing. He has to take it to them.
Yeah.
He has the power. They have the power. They can take out their enemies overnight, literally. And then they'll show the world, you don't F with us. It's over.
Yeah. Now, the application has apparently been submitted. And, of course, the United States, as one of five permanent members of the Security Council, has a veto. So we can go ahead and veto. And I think we've said that we will. I think Obama has at least said that. But it says that the U.S. officials, this is the article from the Wall Street Journal, it says U.S. officials privately acknowledge that they worry about the impact of Washington's standing in the Middle East if it is forced to utilize the veto. And again, I'll have to credit Greg Gutfeld. He was really funny on The Five this week. He says, why don't they, people in the Middle East, for a change, worry about their standing with the United States versus us worrying about our standing with them? It seems like there's been way too much of that lately where we're worried about our stand. Why? Because we say, look, you cannot go outside this process. I mean, I think the negotiations are even a farce. And, even if they had negotiations, they stuck to the terms of the negotiations, I agree that granting the Palestinians a state is probably the beginning of the end for Israel. I don't think it's it can't come out good. Now, the alternative, if this bid for actual statehood, UN statehood, fails, they are also considering presenting a resolution to the UN General Assembly that would give the Palestinian Authority advanced standing at the UN, which I guess without statehood, so it's something less than statehood. And then it says, and allow the Palestinian Authority to join such bodies as the International Criminal Court and the UN Human Rights Committee. Then the article goes on. The article goes on to say Israeli officials worry that the Palestinians could use these forms to charge Israeli military officials with war crimes. End quote. And of course they would do that.
Terrorism would be rewarded, and they'll be sanctioned now by the world to do what they're doing, to continue doing what they're doing.
You know, and as I said, in my experience, the Israelis, especially in the last couple decades, have been fastidious about adhering to the requirements of so-called just war theory, which is a farce anyway. So the idea that you're going to get Israelis up on war crimes, it would just be horrible for them to have to spend any amount of time or resources defending themselves against these charges because the so-called Palestinian Authority was part of those UN bodies. So they've submitted the application. I don't know if the United States is going to have to use its veto or not. But in the meantime, there was an article today in the Wall Street Journal saying that the Palestinian moves, you know, the application in the UN, Palestinian moves reshape attitudes. That's the headline. Now, whose attitude? It's the attitudes of the Palestinians themselves. And it says what it's doing is the Palestinians are now coming to expect less of the negotiations, and they are embracing, surprise, embracing a more confrontational stance towards Israel.
More confrontational.
Yes.
More than killing them.
Lobbing rockets over from the Gaza Strip is not enough. Now they need a more confrontational stance. The interesting thing is what they say that they're going to do for this confrontation. And the next paragraph goes on to say that this could mean challenging Israel using boycotts, demonstrations, and international diplomatic forums more aggressively. And, of course, we saw when Abbas gives the speech and gets a standing ovation that he's getting a good reception, so that might work, right? And then it says those ideas are gaining currency among young Palestinians. It says in a year where peaceful demonstrations have radically altered the political landscape of the Arab world, they increasingly embrace notions of nonviolent resistance. End quote. Now, when you're talking about the so-called Arab Spring and you're talking about demonstrations, nonviolent demonstrations within particular countries, that is an entirely different thing than saying you're going to do the same sort of technique with respect to Israel, because Israel does not share territory with these, you know, people who are in the Palestinian Authority territories or whatever you call them. So what does nonviolent resistance mean in this context? All it could mean is the sort of thing that we saw a couple times earlier this year, where you have just a whole group of people walking across the border, at least on the surface, sorry, I hit something, at least on the surface, not getting any, any weapons. They're not brandishing any weapons. They're not firing any weapons, but a huge mass of people walking across the border. That happened a couple times this year with some borders that Israel shared with neighboring countries. So is that the sort of thing that they mean? And if they are walking across a border when they're not given permission, how is that nonviolent? So I don't understand how they're going to apply these nonviolent resistance techniques in any way that is analogous to what's going on in these other Arab Spring countries. I think it's just a farce. What do they want? They want to actively challenge Israel for sovereignty over the West Bank. But it says, though not necessarily through an armed struggle. This is a quote from one young so-called Palestinian. He says, "We're hoping to have a state. Checkpoints should be dismantled. Palestinians will patrol where Israelis do now." End quote. Now, how is that not a call for violence? I mean, do you have any idea, Bosch, what they mean, how they can use nonviolent resistance with respect to Israel?
Those words. They say those words, like Arafat said, peace. He said the word peace. They gave him a Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay.
That's it. It's just words. That's it. They got to be killed.
It becomes nonviolent by the fact that they stated that
they
it
say.
Is. Okay.
And in their mind, when they say peace, you know what they're thinking.
Right.
Islam.
Yeah, I mean, of course peace happens. When everybody submits to Islam, then it'll be peaceful. It'll be great.
Look, they will never, ever, ever, ever stop until they're stopped. And Israel has to realize that. They have to appreciate that. They have to go in there and bomb their quote-unquote offices. Bomb them. If there are quote-unquote innocent civilians, they will... This is the way it is. I mean, the enemy is built of civilians. Al-Qaeda, all the terrorist groups, they are quote-unquote civilians.
Right.
They hang out with civilians. They dress like civilians. They are civilians. It's civilians waging war on actual countries. I mean, I get so angry at this idea that, you know, they can actually take out this enemy. To hell with the world. You know, tell the world, go to hell. Your people are not being murdered.
Yeah, and Israel doesn't, and I think it's because the U.S. has condemned them. So that's one.
That,
of their...
And also the religion, you know, the religion doesn't allow them to do certain things, and they abide by that. And it's terrible to see. It really is.
This is why I was heartened to hear Cain's comment in the GOP debate, which is our next topic, when he said, "If you mess with Israel, you mess with the United States."
Yeah.
He got quite a few cheers for that. And that's the kind of attitude that we have to have. We don't need a president who publicly calls for Israel to return to these indefensible 1967 borders as a basis for negotiations. And I mean, this is exactly what I predicted, that
those words led to this new push.
Exactly.
100%. He gave them, quote unquote, hope. He gave the enemy hope.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
So now I'm sounding like Rush Limbaugh because I get to say I told you so for the first time. I've had my show only since February, so I have my first I told you so moment.
If he says
but
I told you so.
I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to see that if the president of the United States calls for something and gives moral support to a certain negotiating position, that that's going to be picked up by these Palestinians and used as a weapon against Israel in the court of public opinion. And that's exactly what they're doing, and apparently it's successful.
In spite of Obama, we still are the moral leader of the world, in spite of him.
I'd like to know if Netanyahu got a standing ovation of any kind.
I doubt it. I can't watch any political speech anymore. I really can't, even if it's from a guy that I, you know, somewhat respect. To me, he's a politician. I just can't. I could listen to sound bites and watch them. Obama, I can't even read some of the stuff.
Well, and sometimes you don't want to see how he's treated in reaction too, because that's too disturbing to watch. Now, Ed here says that Syria and Jordan are the ones who denied the Palestinians a homeland. The whole UN Palestinian state is simply another step to eradicating Israel. Yes, Ed. Yeah, and I think that is, it was an Iranian ambassador who said that explicitly. Also, he says Abbas was a trained KGB agent when the Soviets thought that they could use Arab terrorists to their own advantage.
Arafat was also a Soviet tool at one point as well.
Yeah. Now, Paul has a very lengthy comment about Israel's history. As I said, it's a very good resource. If you go to David Horowitz's Freedom Center, they have a lot of resources on Israeli-Palestinian history. John says that there is a Palestinian Arab state. It's already Jordan. You know, Jordan is already one of these. And this is true. I mean, the other surrounding Arab nations should have absorbed these so-called refugees. Actually, there were refugees, right? Because they had this thing that happened in 1948, and so there were a bunch of Jewish refugees, and there were a bunch of Arab refugees. And the Arab states should have absorbed the Arab refugees, because the Jewish state absorbed the Jewish refugees.
But they want a proxy there for them. They want angry, poor, miserable Muslims next to Israel, and they will do anything to do that, to keep that alive. Angry, you know, aggressive, murderous. They will do anything to keep it alive.
Tom reminds us here that when they did the flotilla, they called that nonviolent. Yeah, and of course there were weapons trying to be transported into Hamas on that.
Look,
so that's
they will
that's
call
disgusting.
Gutting a pregnant woman nonviolent if they can get away with it. They will call anything. I mean, to them, anything they do against Israel is nonviolent, because Israel is the aggressor as far as their warped minds. You know, it's Israel has to respond with force. There's no negotiation.
Now we've got Ashwin, who's a new listener here, agreeing with us. So thanks and welcome to the show, Ashwin. Next topic is going to be one that I think makes us feel a little better. Although the beginning part of it, when we talk about the GOP debate, who watched the GOP debate this week? And was it not the most lackluster performance by the GOP candidates
terrible.
So far? It was hard. And now I feel like it's my job to watch these debates. And so then
sorry,
I said, oh my gosh, this was terrible.
Did you want to talk about the UN at all, or are you going to, or no?
You're right. We wanted to say a little bit about the UN in general.
Just one thing I did, it was in response, I guess, some of the Palestinians going up there. But I made a little post, a little fun, and it's a UN symbol with the words and this big fat F, a bloody F in front of the UN, F-U-N, fun. And so two ways I describe the UN, and then I'll get back to you, just 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
The UN, a place where good and evil meet to pretend there's no such thing as good and evil.
Right.
And also one last thing, I've had a cartoon in my head for years, I just never drew it. It's the UN is Batman and Superman sitting down with the Joker and Lex Luthor, only less realistic.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what it is. It's a madhouse. It's where evil dominates. The day that the idea of the UN is obliterated from existence, well, we're on our way to a more rational world.
Well, you had said that John Bolton said that they could get rid of all the floors of the building where the UN are and not lose anything.
He said something like 13 floors or 30 floors. You could wipe them out. He said it very angrily, passionately.
Right.
And you'd lose nothing.
Right.
And his colleagues looked at him as if he was a terrorist.
Well,
just saying those words.
And then, you know, if you want to talk environmentalism, think of all the resources that are expended to have these people flown here, protected within the city of New York and all
absolutely.
That horrible stuff.
Absolutely. And a diplomatic immunity for who knows what they do. You know, even a double parking, they have tickets, otherwise they don't pay them.
Yeah.
It's just sick. Send it to Palestine, you know, in quote unquote Palestine. Build a UN there, have only Muslim countries and some dictatorships and get the hell out.
Well, and it reminds me that John Bolton had the perfect answer to this. He said that what the United States should say to the UN General Assembly is that if any one of them votes for the Palestinians to get their own state through the UN, that we will defund the UN. And apparently that's been done in the past by a president, and I don't know
by
which one, and he didn't say, by a decent president, and it has worked. And people should realize that we're just, not gonna put up with the politics and the grandstanding that they're doing there.
So about the UN.
Yeah. And we could even, if we wanted to get more sick, we could talk about Ahmadinejad having dinner with the Columbia students, but I think I'm done with Islam and Islamic things for this week. So let's go ahead and talk about the debate. Now, like I said, I was, pretty... I don't know, dismayed at the debate.
Watching, right?
It was very lackluster, and I was going to write a post about it, but I lost steam. The debate, the post was going to be called GOP.
You mean like a Rick Perry lost steam?
Yeah, it's like Rick Perry's condition was contagious. I caught it. I couldn't finish my post. I don't know, but it was going to be called GOP debate goes to the dogs, and it goes to the dogs because that's usually a statement to show that it's gone bad somehow. So it was kind of a lackluster debate, but there were a few different hat tips to dogs in the debate, which was the little source of enjoyment and humor that I had in that debate. One was Fox changed their little Time's Up chime so that it didn't sound like a doorbell, because people who had watched previous debates had complained that it sounded like a doorbell and caused their dogs to bark. So they made it sound like something different. So that was good. Kane scored some points during the debate by saying about the current U.S. income tax code, which Mitt Romney has no intention of getting rid of, by the way. Mitt Romney would still keep the current U.S. tax code. Kane says about it, he says, that dog won't hunt. In his very matter-of-fact way, he wants to get rid of the whole U.S. tax code. Johnson had one of the most memorable lines of the whole evening. It turns out that Rush Limbaugh had said something similar, so it's not clear how Johnson heard of this line or if he came up with it himself. But Johnson said, my next-door neighbor's two dogs have created more shovel-ready jobs than this administration, end quote. So, as a dog lover, I really appreciated the references to man's best friend that were made during the debate, but overall I found it to be lackluster. And that could be because I already know what many of the candidates candidates are going to say in response to the questions, because I've heard a few of these debates now. It could be because the candidates are getting a bit fatigued. It seems like the debates are coming up very frequently, and so they aren't giving inspired performances. Or maybe it's just that it's becoming more real to me over time that none of those on stage would be a candidate that I'd be excited, like truly excited to vote for. Because I still think that's true. As much as I am happy that a particular candidate is doing well in the polls, it's not, you know, you have to keep the context here. I'm looking at, this is 2012, this is the hand that we're dealt, and we've got to pick one of these people. And which one is the, which is the least bad? Which one can I be most excited about? But it's not that I'm truly excited to vote for any of them. If I had to choose right now, I would likely choose Kane, with Johnson being a close second. With so many of Johnson's positions, I really do like him, but his foreign policy positions do scare me. And I talked about that a couple weeks ago. I was on a conference call with Johnson, and I had the opportunity to sort of nail him down. And he enunciates a lot of principles that are decent, but his evaluation as to what constitutes a military threat to the United States, I disagree with. And Kane, I know, agrees, you know, he's very strongly in favor of Israel, and he would think that Iran's a threat and all those things that Johnson does not. So
yeah, and he naturally has a suspicion about Islam and jihad, naturally. I mean, you could tell when he speaks about it.
Yeah. Now, Perry, probably to his peril, he shouldn't have done this. He was responding to the question that they had about who would your ideal running mate be, and he said, well, maybe I'll mate Gingrich to Kane. And if you combine Gingrich and Kane, you'll get the ideal running mate. Now, similarly, I think I'd like to combine Johnson and Kane to get the ideal candidate. I would take Johnson on social issues across the board, fine. I would take equal parts Johnson and Kane on economic issues, probably. I think their economic policy is similar, but I think Johnson's better on some things. Like Kane, I think, initially supported the TARP bailouts. Right. That's what I heard. I would hope that he would change his mind on that now, having learned. But that's a little bit of a mark on his record. Then I would take one part, of course, Kane on foreign policy. I think Kane would probably be better on foreign policy, just based on what I've seen so far. Overall impressions, I did notice in this debate a couple of times that Fox chose to pose a hard question, a difficult question, and pose that question to the challengers first. So Johnson would get the question first.
Right.
And then you'd go maybe to Huntsman or Bachman or Santorum. Excuse me?
Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
I said Huntsman, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. You used a pun and I didn't get it. I said, I said his name correctly. But then, you know, at the end, Romney and Perry would get the question, and they have had the benefit of listening to everybody else's answers, of thinking in their own mind. Of course, it didn't help Perry at all, because Perry's, you know, his performance was terrible, and a lot of people commented on it. And it was funny, because I think at the before the debate, Perry had said something about how important this was. Maybe he said something about how important the straw poll was. But then afterwards, he, because he knew he had done badly, he warned people against choosing the slick debater.
Right.
And if, I mean, suppose you thought it was a choice between Romney and Perry. If you think about the fact that part of the president's job is to be able to think on his feet coherently and to be in good physical health, Perry is not doing it for me in that regard. He looked like he was in pain. Some people have speculated as to the fact that he puts his collar very high on his neck. Maybe he's got some sort of neck brace under that his neck is bothering him. He's got some issue with his spine. I know he had some stem cell therapy for, you know, something in his back. So
I think he's resisting the urge to pray, and it keeps looking like he's going down to the ground, you know.
I have no idea, but he looked uncomfortable. He wasn't good on his feet at all. There were some answers that he really could have nailed that he botched.
Totally botched. It was really embarrassing.
Yeah. And I mean, I was sort of feeling sorry for him up until the point where he said that we have no heart unless we want to subsidize illegal aliens' education.
No,
but the thing that also made me not feel sorry for him and made me actually get angry with him was that I realized he was making Romney, who is the champion of Social Security. Remember, he wants to preserve Social Security basically as it is. He's also a champion of the altruist morality on which the Social Security rests, per his comment about, you know, it's at the heart of the GOP to care for those in need. He's making Romney look better. And so I truly thought that even though supposedly Romney wasn't putting any resources into this debate and this straw poll, I thought he'd come out on top because of Perry's poor performance. So I was actually pleasantly surprised. I wasn't shocked, but I was pleasantly surprised. You know, Drudge tends to exaggerate, and Drudge had the headline shock poll that, you know, Herman Cain had won the straw poll in Florida. I wouldn't say I was shocked, but I was pleasantly surprised. Cain did turn in a good performance, a really good performance, and I think the best part of his performance is the clip that's been played quite a lot, and it was the one where he discussed his experience overcoming cancer. And where he details all the different treatments that he had to go through and the diagnoses and then the treatments. And he asserts something that I think is true, that if Obamacare had been in effect, his treatment would have been delayed by government bureaucrats to such an extent that he might not have lived through this cancer. But as it was only the limitations of his own schedule and his ability to recover from the various stages of treatment that limited him in terms of when he could get the next treatment, and so he survived. Apparently, he's been 5 years cancer-free. That does make you worry. You know, could he get cancer again? You know, as a candidate for United States president, you do worry about their health as well. But he seems very healthy. He won the straw poll with 37% of the votes that were cast there. The second place was Perry, 15%. So he didn't even come in within 20 percentage points of Cain. No, that's a resounding victory. So I was very excited for him. It was nice because, you know, Cain in the debates has not pushed the social issues. I know that he's religious. I know he's a religious conservative. It's going to come up, and I'm not going to be happy about it when it does. But he has stayed away from those issues a lot more than a Bachman or a Santorum, and he is much more of an economic conservative than either Perry or Romney. So, you know, like I said, I really like both Johnson and Cain, but I tend to favor Cain a little bit more because of the strong foreign policy that I assume he'll have.
I can see him taking it to Obama as well. I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now,
you know, one thing also about the foreign policy question that Perry got about, let's say, you know, the scenario was, let's say Pakistan has the jihadists have taken over, or whatever term they use, the insurgents have taken over Pakistan's nukes, what would you do? His answer was so lame, so forgettable, something about, well, we have to build relationships, and whoa, the scenario is they got the nukes, what would you do? He wouldn't answer. He dodged it. And it's just pathetic. And also, Submit Romney said something about, they asked him, do you think Obama is a socialist? And he dodged that and said, well, I think I want to call him ex-president. Remember that? Again, another dodge.
And I hated the dodges. Now, the worst at the dodges, I thought, was Huntsman of the large prefaces. Each time he was asked a question, it was like, you know, my beautiful wife is in the audience.
Putzman.
Oh, I know you call him Putzman. But there was one question, and I can't remember what it was now. They went to Huntsman first, and he, you know, used about half his time with a preface and then gave a little bit of an answer. And then they went to Romney, and Romney used the entire time to give prefatory remarks and never made a substantive answer to the
question. And got away with it.
Yeah, and got away with it. If you guys ever are interested, I'm usually tweeting during these debates, and I give out little nuggets here and there. But so it's Amy Peekoff on Twitter. That's all it is. It's Amy Peekoff. I wasn't very creative with it, and I don't have to be, thankfully. Now, Tom here says that he thinks Johnson's better than Cain because Cain is completely fake. When he talks, it's just like Romney Perry to me. He says he sees political responses as opposed to real ideas.
I don't know. I see different. I think it comes up with 10 times more real than both of them put together. I mean, it's you know, he lives in the real world. He's made his bones in the real world. He's not a politician, so he's not slick like these guys.
Now, I tend to like him better over time. I think he's getting better over time at thinking on his feet, and I think it's perhaps because he's becoming more confident, and someone who's more confident is able to just be himself and talk and speak confidently about his platform. This 999 plan that he has is gaining a lot of traction. When he introduced it during the debate, he got cheers just for introducing that. So, now Deborah says that Mark Stein hosted Limbaugh's show the day after the debate, and he went after Romney and Perry for acting like Democrats. It was pretty vindicating. That's excellent. Mark Stein gets better to me all the time.
Oh, he's excellent. Yeah. He's the best villain host, to the point where sometimes I do prefer him than Rush. Actually, most of the time, though.
Now, Ashwin says, I would never vote for someone who legitimizes a black chamber of commerce.
I
guess he has. So that's certainly a mark against him, if true. And this is something that when we actually do have to vote at the end of all this, we're going to have to take into account and weigh
everything.
If it's that versus Romney, who says he's going to preserve Social Security no matter what, and he was the author of Romney Care.
I mean, you know, it's like he installs Romney Care and then says he'll repeal Obamacare. Please, what, he'll repeal it and change the name to Romney Care?
Exactly. And maybe
why the hell would he? On principle, why would he? Philosophically, why would he?
Make it a little less socialist than it is now and put a new label on it, and boom, it'll be fine. I mean, he says he's going to grant waivers. That's the only thing that Romney has said.
He says, I'll give 50 waivers.
He says, I'll give, and this is what he says. He says, I'll give waivers to all 50 states. Now, then I wonder about individuals and businesses. Yeah. Do they get waivers, or is it just the states that get waivers?
They should refer to him as Mitt Romney Care at every time. All of his fellow, you know, they should. And also sub-Mitt Romney, because on Islam, the idiot said, jihad has nothing to do with Islam. It's like, really?
People are liking your sub-Mitt Romney here. They love that coinage. So continue to use it.
Sub-Mitt Romney Care. Yeah, that's his full name.
Yeah, now John says that Kane has a forceful personality, unlike Johnson. And in fact, I looked at this article. It said how Kane won Florida. This was on the Washington Examiner's website, and it was posted just earlier today, way early today. And in terms of why he won, first of all, Perry, supposedly he said that the straw poll in Florida was important to him, but then instead of taking the opportunity to give a speech that might have made up for his lackluster performance during the debate, instead of doing that, he got on a plane and flew off to Michigan. And Kane stayed there, gave a speech that they've described as a barn burner, so it must have been quite a speech, and they said it brought at least 7 standing ovations from the delegates. So this made me happy, because I thought, okay, there were 7 standing ovations for Abbas, which are bad, so then we had 7 standing ovations for Kane, which I bet were probably good. So that was one of the reasons that he won this straw poll. The other thing is, apparently people are coming to terms with this so-called electability issue. The electability issue just bothers me, because they say, oh, well, I want to support Romney because he's electable and Kane is not. What does electable mean? It means that people like him. So if you have a whole bunch of people who say, I like Kane, but he's not electable, no, that means that all those people would support Kane. So
a terrorist friend was electable in the last campaign, 2008.
Yeah.
He was, quote unquote, electable. What, are you kidding me?
No. And I mean, there is so much time to, you know, if the so-called establishment of the GOP, or at least some of the, you know, more conservative media outlets, if they get behind Kane, Kane is electable. I mean, even Palin, even Sarah Palin is now polling only 5 percentage points behind Obama. So you tell me that Kane isn't electable. I think it's garbage. Yeah. Especially if he gets a good running mate, I think it'll be wonderful.
Electable means acceptable to the media. Who the hell wants that?
Right.
I mean, look at the media.
Now, one woman said, she said before she saw Kane's speech that was, you know, in front of the delegates after the debate, she said, I liked Kane, but I wasn't sure he could win. But after I heard this speech, I thought, it doesn't matter if he wins or not. I am for this man. He was awesome. End quote. And that's the kind of thing I would like to see, especially at this stage, people just getting behind those candidates whom they like. And you know, again, take me in context here. If I say I like Kane, it is me trying to sum up all these incommensurate factors that each of these candidates have either before or against them in the context of what we can expect in 2012. It's not like I'm saying the guy's perfect. He's got, you know, some marks against him, certainly. But I liked him in the debate better than I liked anybody else's performance in the debate. And that's all. Sure. That's only because Johnson made a couple of flubs. One was in response to that running mate question, who would you choose as your running mate, which they gave to him first. And again, I thought they were very unfair. They pitched the question to Johnson first, and then everybody else gets to think a lot longer than he does.
And he blew it.
He blew it by saying he would have Ron Paul. Right? So that
he just connected himself to Ron Paul, and you know, and that to me is death knell right there. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the one thing that he blew, and then he blew another question with respect to being able to fly to Cuba.
Right,
and Bachman called him on it, and she was good in that.
Absolutely.
If Cuba is indeed a state sponsor of terrorism, you do not have flights, you know, just going and coming from Cuba.
And he tried to use the free market and free trade as an excuse to do that. It's like, what do you mean? Free trade with what?
Free trade is in a context among people who do not initiate force. And if you've got a state sponsor of terrorism, that doesn't count in the realm of free trade. But people like a lot of, maybe Johnson himself, maybe some of Johnson's fans, but certainly Ron Paul and Ron Paul's fans, they don't even believe in trade sanctions against sponsors of terrorism. It's inconceivable to me that you would say, yeah, free trade, which is on the principle of not initiating force, but you're going to go ahead and trade with people who would initiate force.
Free trade with a country that has no free trade.
Against us. I want to see quick if there's any people who wanted to talk about our candidates. We've got some written comments here. We've got... They all dodged the issue, says Robert, of eliminating federal programs, leaving it to the states as if that bureaucracy is any better. Very disappointing.
Yeah.
Yes, Robert, I agree.
They kept referring to states' rights. States' rights, right.
States' rights, or that the states should handle education. I don't want the state of California handling education anymore than I want the federal government. Somebody today had tweeted out that California is to United States as Greece is to Europe. That we are, you know... And it's true. I don't want them handling education as well. Ashwin says about Obama, Obama's not a strong black man, end quote. He says, do you really want to keep racial-based...
Herman Cain said that, supposedly. Yeah,
Cain said about Obama is not a strong black man. Do you really want to keep racial-based voting alive? No, I don't. And if he does pull the race card, so to speak, a lot, then that's going to count big for me against him. But as I said, I'm looking in the context of these candidates, none of which is
saying,
great. I have to decide.
What he's saying during these debates. What he's saying during these debates. Let's see. Let's see how far he goes.
Well, and how does his ideas change over time, too, if he's going to pull the race card in or not?
I mean, he's clearly gotten better during the debates. He clearly has. The first one, he was pretty mediocre. He's gotten better and better. And the last one, in particular, I don't think he had, as we talked about, any blatant mistakes. I mean, he really didn't.
Now, David here says, you guys think like me too much. Well, it's good, I guess, if we think like you, but maybe it's not good. Maybe we should challenge you, David. I'll try to play devil's advocate a little bit more. He says, Perry is getting foreign policy advice from John Bolton. That might be one good thing if we get stuck with Perry, having Bolton as Secretary of State.
Clearly didn't listen to Bolton about that one question. It was so stupid, incoherent about, about that scenario where the jihadists take over the nukes, and he's like, well, we have to have relations with these people. What does that mean?
Well, you know, this speaks to the fact that some people have said about Perry, he's getting advice from people, but he seems not to be able to internalize the knowledge that he's getting from them. I mean, this is the whole point going back to Warren, right? It's not enough to be surrounded by smart people who are dumping information at you. You have to actually internalize it, make it your own, and be able to apply and communicate it, especially if you're going to do well in these debates.
Sean said that the sound was cutting out.
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? It's because our time is up. It's the gods of the sound telling us that our show is supposed to be
over. I don't believe in them.
You don't believe in the gods of the show or the gods of the sound, the gods of the internet. It's Attack Watch going to the platform and telling them they must shut us down immediately. But we are actually out of time, so I get to do my usual closing blurb. Thank you for listening. During the week, don't forget to check out the blog at don'tletitgo.com. You can subscribe to my blog, which will give you posts whenever I post or give you an email whenever I post. You can find links there to pretty much every other way that you can stay in touch with me. I've got Amy Peekoff on Twitter. I've got Don't Let It Go on her as a page on Facebook, and also iTunes. I've got a link there to my iTunes where you can subscribe and find a bunch of back episodes of the podcast as well. So thank you very much for your participation and for attending this week, and we will talk to you next time. Take care.